Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you. Thank you for joining us tonight. Those of you who are here with me in the Microsoft Canada offices, and as well, we also have a number of people joining us online on the simulcast, and I'd like to welcome all of them as well. And just a reminder for folks who are online and have questions, we have a Joey and Ted monitoring your questions, and they're going to arrange to get those to me. So when I'm taking questions from the room, I can also take questions from online at the same time. So thanks for joining me, no matter how you're joining me, and welcome for the next couple hours. We're going to be talking about Windows 7 development, client development, so writing code that runs on the desktop or laptop or whatnot of the person who is executing your program, right, as distinguished from web application. And the line between web and Windows is kind of blurring, but we're definitely going to be focused on code that's running on the machine where the person is sitting. And I'm breaking it into two pieces. First, we're going to talk about, I'd call it more general material that applies to almost any Windows application. We call it lighting up that application to take advantage of the features that Windows 7 offers. And we'll cover both visual and invisible Windows 7 features and capabilities and how you'd want to add them into your application. Then we're going to take a small break, and then we're going to focus on a very specific opportunity that Windows 7 offers to developers, and that's touch. And how to, again, sort of light up touch capabilities in a regular app, and what to think about if you want to actually build a touch-enabled app from the get-go. So that's our kind of two logical pieces. And we'll start by talking about the code pack. So I have my name here on the slides, Kate Gregory, if you don't already know me. You're welcome to drop me an email about this or any related topic. I get about an email a minute. So please, if you send me an email, choose a nice subject line that lets me know that even though I may not recognize your address, that we know each other. Okay, so put Windows 7 or building awesome apps or something like that in your subject line so that I know that you're not actually offering to sell me Canadian pharmaceuticals, right? I do also blog. There's the link to my blog, and I am on Twitter, and you're welcome to check me out in those venues as well. So for the code pack part of the talk, here's my plan. I'm going to talk to you about the visual stuff first, and the visual stuff is mostly organized around the taskbar. That's what's kind of new and exciting about Windows 7. Okay? And then we will give a good solid coverage of jump lists, overlays, thumbnail buttons, and we'll loop back at the end of that and talk about one particular part of jump lists that people ask for a lot, which is something that kind of stretches or twists the Windows 7 architecture a little bit away from where the designers may have had it in mind, but people have embraced it, and we're going to go and talk about self-referential tasks a bit. Then when we've done the visuals, then I want to talk about some kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. And here's my plan with the behind-the-scenes, both with restart and recovery and with libraries. I want to show you how you can write less code and give your users a better experience. So that seems like a winning combination. Okay, so for both of these, I've got a particular approach you can take where you can maybe give people a feature they've wanted for a while writing very, very little code yourself. That would be a win for everybody. Because really, here's my deal. If you're writing a Windows application, it should be a Windows 7 application. And I don't just mean that it should run on Windows 7 without blowing up. Let's kind of take that as a given, okay? Windows 7's been here for a year now. If you still have some app that blows up when you try to run it on Windows 7, you have to do some work, you know, with user account control and some of the other issues. People got away with a lot under XP. You know, oh, let's just hard code this path to C, documents and settings. That was never right, okay? But what would happen is if it blew up, you'd be like, well, why have you installed your Windows weirdly? Put everything under documents and settings and life will be good. Now, all that completely breaks when you try to move it to 7. So I'm going to assume you've fixed all that, you're following nice best practices, and your app at least runs on Windows 7. Really, what I'm going to convince you of, it should sing on Windows 7. And here's why. Give me a show of hands. How many of you use Windows 7 yourself regularly? I get just about every hand in the room, right? And hopefully, if you're watching on the webcast, you've got your hand in the air at home, too. Now, how many of you are maintaining a Windows app whose users use Windows 7 regularly? Oh, way less hands, like maybe a tenth of you. Okay? And this is a tour I'm doing. You guys aren't my first stop. I get this same thing every city that I go to. The developers, oh yeah, I'm all over Windows 7. Love it, adore it. My users, a little behind me, right? That's okay. That means you got a little time. But I want you to think about your experience when you switched on to Windows 7. Okay? I want you to think about some of the apps that you used that didn't take full advantage of the features that the OS offered at first. And the number one example I like to use is Visual Studio 2008. Who's used 2008 on Windows 7? But looks like over half of you. So, you know, if I right-click on Word, I get a nice jump list of all of the Word documents I've opened recently. If I right-click on the taskbar for Notepad, I get a jump list of all the text files I've opened recently with text files with Notepad. If I right-click on Visual Studio 2008, what do I get? Oh, I get a sad trombone is what I get, right? I get, like, some CSS file, some little XML file, like random weird stuff that I happen to have opened, typically using the file open menu in 2008. What I don't get, what I'm expecting, is solution files. Now, for Visual Studio 2010, you do. And I'm not mocking 2008, okay? It was released before Windows 7, okay? It has a perfectly good excuse. The very next version that came out got it right. So I right-click on Visual Studio 2010. There are solutions I've opened recently. And I love it because I open code that's all over my machine in different working folders for different clients and for different demos. And to be able to not have to worry about exactly where it is, just right-click Visual Studio, open the solution file. But if you think about those of you who ran into this for 2008, you kind of felt a little sad, right? A little pang. Like, oh, I really wanted, when I right-clicked on the taskbar, I wanted to see solutions that I'd opened recently. So I want to say about your application, don't be that guy, right? Your application should not make your users go, oh, I wanted it to do that thing. So let's take advantage of everything that Windows 7 offers to your app, and then we're going to communicate to the user the way they're expecting to be communicated to, going to keep them in that mood that Windows 7 puts them in about how the user's in control, your app is considerate and thoughtful and all those things by taking advantage of these features. The way that you're going to do it super easy is using the Windows API Code Pack. The Windows API Code Pack is a managed library that's provided by Microsoft to developers, no charge. It's not a product, you can't buy it. It's just a library that you can get from the Code Gallery. Okay? Now, the Code Gallery URL is down here on the bottom, code.msdn.microsoft.com/Windows API Code Pack. And any code that's on the Code Gallery is provided by Microsoft people. Okay? You have to be a Microsoft employee to upload there. It's not like CodePlex or SourceForge or some kind of all-comers, anybody can upload anything. This is code from Microsoft, okay? But it's not a product, you can't buy it, all you can do is come and get it here. It wraps up a ton of Windows 7 features to make them easy to call for managed code. Because the operating system's written in native code, is not running on the CLR, it's written in C++, among other things, long story. So the interop to call that capability for managed code can be kind of difficult. Now, pinvoke's not hard. Lots of you can probably do pinvoke, but there's some seriously, and I love interop, there's some seriously scary interop involved in getting to some of these capabilities. So the folks who wrote the code pack did that trouble for you. Okay? All you need to do is download it, then you can add reference in your project and go ahead and use it. So let me show you. This is the code.msdn.microsoft.com/Windows API Code Pack home page. You can see here there's a list of the various capabilities that it offers. You can click on this Downloads tab and download the most recent version. You can join in with discussions with other developers who are having some kind of issues or problems, want to know how to do things. There's also a full-on issue tracker, so if you think you find a bug, you can actually just fix it in your copy. That's what you need to do. But you can also say, oh, I'd really like someone to look at this. And you know what? Somebody just might. Okay? Before you start using it, you should totally read the license. I am so not your lawyer. But I have to tell you, the license is pretty good. It's basically like, go ahead and use it. Okay? You compile it, make DLLs, take a reference to it, redistribute it with your app if you need to, change it and redistribute the changed version if you need to. It's okay if you're selling your app for money. Pretty much the only thing you can't do is start selling this library and claim that you own it and you wrote it and it's yours to sell. Anything short of that you can do. Okay? To be fair, the other thing you can't do is phone technical support. So if you've got a problem with Visual Studio, you can use like an MSDN support incident, right? You can't use an MSDN support incident to get help with the code pack because it's not a product. Okay? It's just a library that you're being given as a gift. Treat it as though you you own it and you wrote it, other than asking credit for it. Now, most of the samples that I'm going to show you, the demos that I'm going to show you in the CodePack part, actually come with the CodePack itself. So if you download it, you get these three folders: binary, documentation, and source. The binary's got these DLLs that you can actually add a reference to in your own code. And in the source, there's the actual source for the entire code pack, which you can open up in either Visual Studio 2008 or 2010 and read. It's a great interop reference if you want to learn how to do some of this more complicated interop. Or, more realistically, you can just ignore that, add references to it, and there's all these cool samples. Okay? So the first few samples I'm going to show you just come with the code pack. You don't need to email me and ask me for the code. When you download the code pack, you get these samples and you're ready to rock. I am going to show you a handful of samples that are not yet released anywhere. Their name is the Windows 7 recipes, and they're going to be put onto Code Gallery. Okay? When they're put on Code Gallery, what's going to happen at that time is here where it says related resource pages, there will be more links to these recipes from there. So that's how you're going to find them when they're released. The plan was they'd be released once a week through November. Everyone who's calendar trained may have noticed that we've had several weeks now in November, and they're not there yet, but I'm sure they'll be there really soon. We had the PDC, we had Tech Ed Europe, there was a lot going on. I'm sure they'll be along soon. So they should be easy to find from the CodePack page, and generally speaking, the recipes take a dependency on CodePack, but they go a step further, and they show you how to do some very specific capabilities that maybe the built-in samples don't help you with. So let's start with a taskbar integration, and specifically with the jump lists. This is the number one kind of visually obvious thing about Windows 7. People fire up Windows 7, they look at it, the taskbar looks different, the quick launch is gone, the system tray is less important, and if they right-click on icons and they get jump lists, that's the fundamentally first thing you demo people. So I just want to do some terminology and some nomenclature about a jump list for an application. First, I want to distinguish between nouns and verbs, between destinations and tasks. When you right-click on, let's say, Word, it shows you Word documents you've opened recently. If you click one of those on this jump list, it will launch another copy of Word and open that. So if you had Word open, now you have two open. If you didn't have Word open, you'll go from 0 to 1. If for some reason you had 7 Word documents already open and you right-click and chose something, you'd get an 8th copy of Word. Okay? That's the architecture of the destinations on the jump list. Launch another copy of the same exe. The tasks launch potentially a different exe. In fact, the architecture was very definitely a different exe. So the examples that are given is, okay, how about we launch Notepad and pass it a command parameter to open your readme.txt? How about we launch Internet Explorer and we pass it a parameter to open the URL to contact us or help or getting support? How about we open the help viewer to open your help document, and so on. Okay? That was the idea behind tasks. And that's the sort of straight-up, out-of-the-box task behavior that I'm going to talk about in the first few demos around tasks. I'm going to circle back later to visit tasks again. Now, one of the things that a user can do with a jump list is they can pin individual items to the list. So if there's something that you don't open very often, but it is important to you, you personally can pin it onto the list. Say it's a Word document. Word can't control that pinning. And people often come to me and they say, what can I do in my application so that I can pin something to the list for my users? You cannot. Okay? You cannot. However, you can achieve essentially the same thing. If you look closely in this screenshot, you see we've got pinned. Underneath that, we've got recent. And underneath that, we've got important. Important is a custom category that was added in code by this application, and it will always show up. So let's say you have an application in which people submit the expense accounts. And you have like templates, like starting points. You have one for foreign travel, one for domestic travel, one for buying something, like you go to Staples and buy a printer. You could put those three templates, probably wouldn't call it important, you'd probably call it templates, and then people could always open that document, even if they'd never opened it at all or hadn't opened it for ages. So it's like pinning, okay? So pinning is technically belongs only to the user, but you have these custom categories, and that gives you that kind of control of being able to say, I want this always to be available for my user to launch if they want to. The other thing that's interesting about the taskbar is the overlays. So in this particular screenshot, the little blue eye and the red X are both icon overlays that are on top of the regular icon for this application to indicate something's going on. I have information for you, or I have presumably an error for you, right? That's the traditional red X meaning. And you'll see this Outlook will put a little mail envelope icon when you have new mail. A lot of Twitter clients will put a number indicating how many tweets there have been since the last time you looked, and so on. People are now expecting their notifications to be there, not way over in the system tray. They don't like Toast or balloon pop-ups or other kind of irritating, interrupty things. I get especially annoyed by Toast that comes up over my scroll bar in a different app, and I'm trying to scroll something and there's Toast in the way. So these little notification icons, they're not intrusive, but they really do get everyone's attention. And also, when you do usability studies, you find the fact that your eye is already looking at the icon really helps you to quickly mouse exactly to where you need to bring the app up to deal with what you're being notified about. So these overlay icons are super important and super easy, as you'll see. Now, the second shot also shows a progress bar. And you've probably already noticed this. When you do a download with Internet Explorer, when you copy a fairly large file just using Windows Explorers to copy files between folders, and a handful of other apps that are now sort of Windows 7 aware, where the progress bar actually occurs right in the taskbar as well as in some dialog. And it's fantastic because you can put it completely in the background so that all you have is a taskbar, and yet you can still monitor its progress while you work on something else. Now, there's one trick to this. How many of you have your taskbar set to large icons by show of hands? I get like one or two hands in the whole room. The rest of you are all big, small icon users, right? Well, you're going to have to switch. You get these overlays when you are on large icons. So a long time ago, over a year ago, when I first started demoing Windows 7, I would put my machine on large icons just for the demo. And I'd be like, oh, I can't wait to get back to my proper small icon self where I get those 7 pixels back for seeing all my important code and documents and everything. Do you know what I found? I found that these overlays were so important to me that I am 100% a large icons person now. So if you haven't given them a whirl yet, switch to large icons for a week and see if you don't feel the same way. Now, let me show you how this all comes together in some code, because that's what we're all about, right? I have a demo running here, and this is one of the demos that comes with the code pack. Its name, as you can see, is Taskbar Demo. And everything in the code pack, all of the samples come in both VB and C#, and they have exactly the same functionality in both languages. Okay? So you can open up whatever you like. I happen to have opened up the VB version. There's a C# version if that would be your preference. Okay? Now, the thing about these demos is, they've got controls here on the dialog to let you set things that really you would just put in your code. Okay? So you don't want to give the user the choice of whether your dropdown shows recent, frequent, or none. That's bizarre. But this is a demo, so that's why we do that. You would actually make a decision. When your app loads, you would set it to recent, frequent, or none, right? So right now, this thing is on frequent, and it opens text files. So you can see some text files that I may have opened frequently. If I switch it to recent, it now shows, well, the word recent here, and the order may have flipped around a little bit. It's hard to be sure. I can also set it to none if I want, but this is a document-oriented application, so I'm not going to set it to none. Those custom categories like important, now I have one. Okay? Now, the code for this, very, very simple to do. Let's actually just go in and look at the handler for this button. I wasn't expecting that to be a difficult thing to ask of Visual Studio. There we go. So what you would really do in here is you would say it was going to be templates. You'd have something in your config file, right, that says here's the folder where templates live. Then you'd go and enumerate all of the files in the template directory and you'd add them into the category one at a time. What we do is every time you click the button, we add test one, test two, test three, and so on. So I'm going to kind of skip over all that because that's kind of gibberish. But it is key that there is a path, which is the full path to the destination that you want to add. And then we have this member variable, category 1, and I'll show you where he came from in a minute. And he has a method called add jump list items. And you just make a new jump list item out of the path. So nothing to that, right? If you were enumerating files, you'd be in a loop, and for each one, you'd call add jump list items. Now, where category 1 came from, they are member variables category 1 and 2 of this form, and they're of type jump list custom category. And we have references. We've actually incorporated the projects by reference in here to the Windows API Copack.shell, which is where you'll find jump list custom category. Now, you'll notice we have this guy here, category 2, as well. And when we create the application, we actually add both 1 and 2 in. 2's not there right now because a category is invisible if it doesn't have any files in it. So after you add some jump list items into the custom category, like here with calling add jump list items, then it becomes a visible. Now, the other thing is that there's a property on that category called name. So when we first created this one, we passed in a name. Very exciting, custom category 1, which you see right there. But if you want to, you can change the name to something else. If you know for sure what you want the name to be, just pass the correct name in the constructor. But maybe you'd actually have a situation dynamically where you wanted to change the name. Well, it's just available as a property. So come back down around to here. You can set the property name to whatever you wanted it to be. Okay. So setting up your destinations, recent, frequent, none, adding in your own custom categories, 1-2 lines of code, nothing to it. And what about adding tasks? So if I click the Add Tasks button on here, by the way, the reason on the demo I have to click Refresh Jump List all the time, in your code, imagine if you were building up your jump list exactly the way you liked it, with the right destinations, the right custom categories, the right tasks, and you were only halfway through it, you'd only added 1 or 2 of the tasks, and somebody right-clicked, you wouldn't want a half-built jump list to be displayed. So you get it the way you like it, and then you commit it. And in the demo, they've bound that committing to this button labeled Refresh Jump List. In your code, you're not going to have any buttons or anything. You're just going to do what you need to do, and then you're going to commit it, right? So once the tasks are added in, now our jump list looks like this. So I'm just going to show you how those tasks got added in. I think you're going to mostly use tasks to launch related applications that depend on what your app does. So you might launch Notepad with your README or Internet Explorer with your Contact Us. But if you have a suite of applications, you might launch the other apps in your suite, right? Or if you've got some application that a lot of sysadmins use, you might have it launch some other utilities like Performance Monitor or the Event Viewer or what have you. Just handy things to help people out. This is a demo that's going to be installed on a machine that I don't know what else it has. So we say, okay, you know what? I'm sure you've got Notepad and Paint and Calculator. I can count on that. And so those are the highly exciting things that we launch, okay? And we know that those are in System 32, right? So let me just show you a bit of a best practice, which is never, ever hard code a path. You don't know the path to System 32. They may not even have a C drive for all you know, right? Windows might be installed on D. Don't be trying to get smart. Plus, they could be multilingual. So we've got this in enum called environment.specialfolder, and you can get a hold of the system folder there, which maps to Windows System 32. And then you can call get folder path on that, and you'll actually get the full path. So then what I'm doing is I'm using path.combine, and I'm sticking these different executable names onto the end of System 32. But you use the path to where your executables are. So I have the exe, full path to the exe, and the second parameter here when I'm making this jump list link is a string. Could be anything. Contact us, read the README. Doesn't have to. You don't have to say the name of the executable if you don't want to. We do. We say open Notepad, open Paint, open Calculator. And that's because it says here, open Notepad, open Paint, and so on. The third part of the business for a jump list link is the icon reference. Now, you can make the icon whatever you like. If you're going to launch the readme.txt, you might like the icon to be a question mark for help. If you're going to launch the Contact Us page, you might like the icon to be your logo. What we're doing here in this demo is we're taking advantage of the fact that executables have icons embedded in them. So we're actually taking that path to Notepad in this case and calling the icon reference constructor that takes that path along with an index, 0, meaning I want the first one in the file. And that's why we actually have the real Notepad icon, the real Paint icon, and the real Calculator icon here in our tasks. You're not obliged to use the icon of the executable you're launching. Okay? Use an icon that makes sense for you. See here where I have a new jump list separator? That's how that comes out. People sometimes want a separator in their custom categories. You can't have that. Just have two custom categories. Okay? Then they'll be separated by their category names. So that's the top half of this app. The second half, the bottom half of this app, does the overlays. And they show up better when the app doesn't have focus. So I'm going to put a yellow overlay. And again, you would never have this in your code, buttons for people to choose their overlays. What you'd have in your code is something would happen, right? A new purchase order would arrive for you to approve, or a new message would arrive, or something would catch fire, okay? And you would decide that you need to notify the user about it, so you would put this yellow or red or whatever square onto the icon, okay? Super easy thing to do. The other thing we might want to put on there is a progress bar. I don't think anyone in the world has progress bars that are hooked to track bars and sliders like this. I wonder how much done we are. I want to be almost completely done. Let's go up to here. That's not really how it works, right? But it does show up nicely on the demo if I don't have to wait while something copies or downloads or whatever, so that's why we've connected it to the track bar. Now, you can see it better if I take him out of focus. So let's put Visual Studio in focus, and you can see down here that progress bar, that green progress bar going across. It's a nice effect. It's really easy to understand. Users get it right away. Even if you don't have a progress bar on here, when you start running a green line across their taskbar icon, they know what you're telling them. Okay? One of the fun things about the taskbar progress bar is it doesn't just come in green. So I can have a red one or a yellow one, or this bizarro, very Star Trek-looking indeterminate one. Looks kind of bleh on here. They irritate me, actually, on here. But when it's down there, it's got that like processing kind of vibe to it. That's kind of fun. So how hard is it for you to set the value of the progress bar or the color of the progress bar or to add these icon overlays? It's practically trivial. Let's take a look at the handler for when you change the track bar. We have two progress bars to worry about, this one that's on the main dialog and this one down here. And we have two lines of code in this handler, okay? One that sets the visible progress bar, this guy, to whatever you just dragged the slider to, and one that takes care of your taskbar one. So taskbar manager has an instance property, and that has a set progress value method. Set progress value takes two numbers, what we're at and what that's out of. So you don't have to convert to a percentage yourself. If you're at 11,000 out of 13,000, just pass those two numbers in and it'll work it out. How did I change the color? Well, it's a drop-down box. You would never have a drop-down box. Something would happen, right? Your copy would start to fail and you'd be like, oh, I have to set my progress bar to being in an error condition. We have this set progress state method. This Windows taskbar is just a local variable that I set equal to taskbarManager.instance. And this set progress state takes this enum taskbar progress state that you see right here. And if I just go to that, error, indeterminate, no progress, normal, and paused, which is probably not a big surprise because that's what you saw in the dropdown. Right? Those are your choices for the state of your progress bar. Defaults to normal. So you've got one line of code to set the value and one line of code to set the state. It's exhausting, isn't it, having those progress bar overlays? Oh my goodness. We have a whole bump of code in the demo which deals with things like if you say you want a progress bar but the slider is at zero, we should move it up to 20% so you can see that something happened. That's all completely fake. You wouldn't care about that in your app. One more thing I want to show you, and that's those overlay icons. One line of code also. So we get hold of the Windows taskbar, call this set overlay icon. Okay, the set overlay icon method takes an icon. Mine come out of my resources. You can see them here, green, red, and yellow. Here's green. It's exhaustingly difficult. I know, I stayed up all night making this icon. You know, you could set to work, not in this tool, hopefully in something else, and build an icon that looks like an envelope or an exclamation mark or a fire or whatever it is you're trying to notify people about. Now, the third parameter to this call is the alternate text. It's not your job to show the alternate text. Windows will take care of that. But green is a very, very bad alternate text. In my demo, that's all I have. I have a green square, a yellow square, a red square. What else can I possibly say? But in your real life, you maybe have a picture of the number one. Your alternate text could be one new message. You have a picture of flames. Your alternate text could be something is on fire. You have a picture of an envelope. You have new mail. Like, make sure your alternate text makes sense to the people who can't see your images. Don't just describe the image. That's not helpful. So, super, super easy to take control of your taskbar and give users a full-on Windows 7 experience where they're getting jump lists the way they like it, they're getting progress bar overlays, they're getting icon overlays, that they can really expect to get their notifications the same way all their other Windows 7 applications give them their notifications. Now, I'm just repeating the code in the slides because we have a plan to get the slides to you somehow when we're done, along with the recording of the webcast for those who aren't with us live. And so you don't need to look at this now. You can look at it if you get the slides. So I need to talk about thumbnail buttons. You know that as you move around over these different applications, you get these little thumbnails that show you the app. But you may not know, depending on the apps you run, about these thumbnail buttons. You know, you're listening to something on Media Player and the phone rings and you need to quickly pause it. You can actually just pause over the taskbar icon, a little thumbnail pops up and there's a button in it, including a pause button, and you can pause that video. There's also the buttons now in Messenger, if you've updated to the latest Messenger, to change your status to online, away, busy, appear offline, and so on. Again, just right from hovering over the thumbnail. Super lightweight, users get it right away. And you know, the bigger our screens get, the more of an effort it is to actually mouse all the way up to wherever that application is to click the buttons in the UI. So you find that thumbnail buttons are really well accepted. And they're not hard to do at all. Let me bring up my thumbnail demo for you. This is within the samples that come with the code pack under Shell, Thumbnail Toolbar Demo. And I believe it's C-sharp's turn, because that first guy was VB. So I'll open that up. And while he loads, I'll run him. Sure, why Windows Explorer wants to go for a nap right now. Now, forgive me because this is an image viewer, and I understand that the world has more than enough image viewers, and that some over half of all the demos you ever see are image viewers, but they have the advantage that we all kind of know how to work them, and you can all tell immediately that they're doing something. So if I actually wrote an application that like approved expense accounts or approved purchase orders or something, how would you know, oh, that's definitely a good one to approve or whatever? But you can easily see that if I click on here, you see a different cheesecake. Or if I click on here, you see this picture of a volcano erupting through a glacier. And if I click on the arrows, you know, we move through the images sequentially. That's obvious and easy to understand how it's working. In this app, we also have this button to go all the way to the beginning, this app to go all the way to the end. So imagine you wrote this app. It works beautifully. It's wonderful. You tested it on XP and Windows 7, everyone likes it. Your QA people have been all over it. You notice it does smart things around disabling the buttons when you're at the end or disabling the buttons when you're at the beginning. It's great. You're ready to release it. And then someone says, you know what would be cool? Thumbnail buttons. This app already has them, so let me show them to you. See here? These are the little thumbnail buttons. And they do exactly the same thing as these buttons up here do, which is no coincidence. I click here and we just move from picture to picture. Or I go all the way to the end, or I go all the way to the beginning, or anything in between. So they work. And for the user, you know, they hover here and they bring it up and they can work on these little buttons instead of having to mouse all the way up to here. And the app doesn't have to be in front. If the app's in front, it's kind of pointless actually. So let's do it here where Visual Studio's in front. And we scroll from picture to picture, and if we hover, you can see we're actually controlling the real application with these little thumbnail buttons, even though it doesn't have focus. And then it comes up and you can see it. Okay? So how is this done? In order to do that, I have to show you the design for the app. This big guy here can see the names of the controls up at the top of the properties window, is picture box 1. This down here is list view 1, and then here we have 4 tool strip buttons, and their names all start tool strip buttons. So you have tool strip button first, previous, next, and last. Now the tool strip buttons do not have their images hooked up inside the designer, but they do have their handlers. So if I double click tool strip button first, we end up editing this code for button first click. That's an important thing to know, because you'll see other things using this handler as well, and it's really the secret to making thumbnail toolbar buttons work. Scroll up here to where we create the application. We have 4 member variables and of type thumbnail toolbar button, and thumbnail toolbar button is from the code pack, that don't get newed up until the form is shown. And then for each one, we new it up using the exact same icon image that we used for the other buttons, so we're leveraging the buttons. And then when we add the handlers, we share the handlers. So this button first click is the handler for the tool strip button as well. So the thumbnail button and the tool strip button are using the exact same handler. You have no code to write. You have no code to test. You're done. This is a really good thing. Okay? And that's why when you click the first button, it does the same thing as if you were to click the first button up here, because it's running the same code. So this is a really, really low effort add into your application. Now, not every app deserves it. Okay? Makes sense for Windows Media Player. Makes sense for Messenger. Does it make sense for approving purchase orders that you would like hover over and go, oh yeah, that looks great. I'm going to click the green check on that one. Oh no, that one's a red X. I'm denying that purchase order. Probably not, right? So work it out according to the business needs of your app, but know that the code is super simple to do. Now before we leave this demo, I want to show you something else that I bet you haven't noticed. And that's about that thumbnail itself. Take a look again at the thumbnail for Visual Studio. Okay? You see that it's an exact miniaturization of Thumbnail Studio, of Visual Studio? Even to like here, let's change my view for a minute. There's the Solution Explorer. Here's the toolbars across the top. You can't read them, of course. They're kind of just wasted space. And it's cluttered to have all that Chrome showing. If I look at PowerPoint, here's my slide sorter. It's kind of not that attractive. Now look at this guy again and compare it to the real app. You see how that Chrome has like disappeared? And maybe you didn't notice till I showed you, but it's nice, right? Gives you like a positive opinion of that application, that somebody gave it a cleaner, sharper thumbnail. So are you prepared to put in the exhausting effort to have a cleaner, nicer thumbnail? Because it's one line of code. Well, don't tell your boss. Maybe you could get away with pretending it was 10 lines of code. Let me show you the one line. After we set up all our thumbnail buttons and we added them in, and by the way, you have to add them all in with a single add, because Windows centers them appropriately, so you add them all in together. Then we have this taskbar manager.instance, which is the same guy we were talking to in the previous demo when we were setting our overlays. He has this method called setThumbnailClip. SetThumbnailClip takes a rectangle. And it's a trick, but it's a damn good trick. Remember we had picture box 1? We say, I tell you what rectangle I want you to use make my miniature thumbnail. I want you to use the rectangle that starts where picture box starts and that is the size the picture box is. That's why the clip comes up exactly with what's in picture box. And you probably have a single control that's your canvas or your grid or your whatever that you would like to use in your clip. So you can use this exact trick. Get the location of that control, get the size of that control, use them to build a rectangle, pass that to set thumbnail clip. Super easy, and it's a really, really nice effect. Now that's just the code for you. So then, single instance tasks. These are kind of complicated. You're not supposed to use tasks like this to talk to yourself. That wasn't the plan. Supposed to be for launching another app, and yet Outlook did it. And whatever Office does, everybody wants to copy. In order to send a message to yourself, you have to do one of two things. Either you write a completely separate companion app that when it launches, all it does is send a message to the first app and then it exits. And then you have deploy issues because now you've got to deploy two EXEs, going to make your life tricky if you're in ClickOnceLand or anything like that. Or you modify your own app to be what's called a single instance app. So that if anyone tries to launch a second instance, all the second instance does is take its parameters and pass them over to the other app and then exit. And that's what our demo does. Now this demo is one of the recipes, so it has not been released yet, but you can watch for it on the CodePack code gallery eventually. Not the folder I want. I'm going to start this app running. And it doesn't do anything other than it changes its color in response to me choosing these tasks. Okay, so this is not actually a messenger client or anything like that, but it will if I click online, change itself to green. If I click away, change itself to yellow. And if I click busy, change itself to red. Okay. The way that it does that is something that you wouldn't probably normally do, and that's you've got to go into program.cs. When you create a Windows Forms or WPF application, you get this program.cs or program.vb with these three lines in it. And what I need you to do in order to use this recipe is to add a reference to this single instance project and then wrap your three lines of code that were generated for you in the lifetime of this thing called a single instance manager. And this is makes your application a single instance application. So that when someone runs a second one, it just takes your parameters and passes them back to the first. These three lines down here set that up. They're kind of boilerplate. You're welcome to just use them as is. You can see we're setting an arguments handler and an arguments handler invoker. And the arguments handler is code of your own. We go to the definition of that. You can see we figure out what we've been passed in, and we cast it to this status enum. And then if it's online, we make ourselves green. If it's away, we make ourselves yellow, and so on. Super simple at that point. And just rely on the recipe to do the work. What it actually does under the scenes, for those who care, is it sets up a global cross-process mutex. And when the second app tries to acquire the mutex, if it has to wait, it says, oh, I'm not first, and it marshals over the arguments to the delegate that you set up when you created the single instance manager. One other thing I want to show you in here, it's not related to exactly to tasks, but it's just for anything. People ask me all the time, what will happen if I run these samples on XP? Sometimes, nothing. You're just trying to do something that gets ignored. But other times, your app will actually blow up. You'll get like an entry point not found exception in a Windows DLL. Okay? So you should check. When you're going to use a Windows 7 feature, you should check that you're on Windows 7. And this core helpers is a class in the API code pack. And he's got properties like running on Windows 7, running on Vista. He's got a number of helpers to help you figure out where you should be. So here we've wrapped up that call to set overlay icon in an if to make sure that we're running on Windows 7. That's definitely a best practice for you. Now I have one more code pack demo, but we also need to fit in a break. Ted, should I show my libraries demo and then break, or should we break now? Keep going? All right, excellent. So libraries, that's just the code that you'll get. Libraries are a way for you to talk to multiple folders at once. And a library is not, a folder isn't really in a library. All that's in a library is a pointer. Okay, so if you delete the library, nothing happens to the underlying folder. If you delete the library out of the folder, the folder out of the library, the original folder is still where it always was on your hard drive. All that's in the library is pointers. Okay? And they can span machines. So I can create a library called, let's say, pictures, that includes a pictures folder on my laptop, a pictures server on the family server, and a pictures folder on other members of my family's machines. And then I can sort them by date or by tag or whatnot and look through all of the pictures at once. What does that mean to you as a developer? Imagine that you have a setting in your config file for a path to a folder. Maybe it's where people like to save their stuff. Maybe it's where people like to open their stuff from. Or maybe it's a magic folder that you monitor. You now have to write UI in your config in your app to let people change that config setting, right? They say, well, I understand there's a file of XML. I don't like editing XML. I want you to put a button in your app that lets me change my magic folder that you monitor. Okay, fine. Then they say, oh yeah, I'd like to be able to monitor two folders. Oh, great. Now you got to add UI with like an add and remove button, and what do you do if they take the last one out and da-da-da-da-da. You got to write a ton of code. Then they say, oh yeah, I'd also like it if the folders could be anywhere on the network. And you need to be graceful about when the machine isn't on the network. And you're going to have to write a lot of code, and you're going to get pretty unhappy. So let me tell you what I want you to do. Hard code the name of a library. Create the library for them and let them use Windows to put folders in and out of the library. They want to put one folder in the library, they can put one folder in the library. Want to put seven? Let them put seven. They want to put them from all different machines? Let them from all different machines. And you just talk to the library. So you write almost no code, and they get way better functionality, and we all live happily ever after. Okay? So let me show you the code for this, because it's kind of fun. So this is just a WPF application that's going to work with a hard-coded library name, and I've got a really simple UI that lets you create it, open a file from it, and so forth. And really, you would do a very similar thing, but you would not constantly add things to a list box that said what you were doing, which is what this code does all over the place. It's like, ooh, you clicked the button, I created the library. You would not do that, okay? But other than that, these are the sorts of things that you would be likely to do within your application. So first I want to show you, these are my libraries. There's no library called Kate Demo at the moment. If I click this button here that says Set Up Library, now there is a library called Kate Demo. And also this thing comes up. Now, this particular dialog is not a dialog of my own, although I'm launching it. It's actually a Windows dialog that with one line of code I caused to come up. Now, these strings, demo, library manager, manage the Kate library demo, and so forth, do come from my code, but everything else is done by Windows. So I can add some libraries, some folders into the library. And you can see these here. You can say OK. If I come in here, go into that library, see where it says two locations, and I click? It's exact same URL, the exact same UI. So your users don't even necessarily need a button in your code to manage their libraries if you could train them to go do this. They could then say, oh, you know what, I don't want my virtual hard drives included in this library. I only want it to be my recipes. Fine. They can add things on different machines, whatever they want to do. So with very little effort for you, you can create libraries and you can give them that first managed UI to play with, but then after that, you could either have them another button or they could just go in through Windows itself to add folders into the library. The code for this, to create the library, basically, it's three lines of code. All this is talking into that list box. So I added this item into the list box, so ignore those. What really matters is that out of the code pack, I newed up something called a shell library. And that has a name, Kate Demo, which you recognize. And this is true or false, is it okay if it already exists? So here I've said, no, it's not okay. So if I click it again, I get an error when I try to create it when it already exists. Then I need that variable lib to go out of scope to be disposed, because that's when we commit the changes into the OS. Having done that, I then have, again, one line of code to call show manage library UI. For this library. And then we have these strings that you saw, demo library manager, manage the Kate demo library. You can put whatever you like in there. That's all that launched that. So super, super easy to do. So you want to open a file and use that as your starting point. You can see that this opens up in the Kate demo library. I could pick a file. And when I say open, it shows me the real original path of where that file is on the hard drive, not relative to the library. It's perfect if you want to open it or copy it or whatever you want to do with that file. This is using the common file open dialog that comes in the code pack. So I can new that dialog up and just set some properties like the title. And there's these properties for the default directory. You can pass in a path, or you can use default directory shell container. See, a library is not really a folder, right? It's something a little weirder, a little more abstract, so it's called a shell container. And you can set that property using the parsing name of your library. So that's how we set that. Having done that, it's simply a matter of showing the dialog and then asking the dialog for this property file name, what the person picked. Okay? Super, super easy to do. Now, what if we're monitoring a magic folder? When files arrive in the folder, we're going to process them in some way. That's a very common thing. And this way, you can monitor across 6 different machines on the network. All you got to do is set up a library and put those folders from the different machines into the library, and you just monitor the single library. So I'm going to click Watch, and I'm going to come in here, and I'm going to delete one of these files. You can see back here in my app, an item delete was detected. Cool. Then I say, oh, why would I delete my chocolate cake recipe? I need that back. So I undo, and an item create was detected. So your code can easily react and do something more exciting than putting things into a list box. Okay. The other thing that can happen with a library, as you saw, is we can change the locations. So if I decide, yeah, I am going to put the virtual hard drive directory back in here after all, say OK. In here, you'll see library Kate demo definition changed. See, because that's fundamentally different from I'm watching this folder and you put a file in it versus you put a whole folder in here. Right? And your magic folder monitoring code maybe needs to go off and process that whole folder now. So all that information is super easily available. We set up our watching. The key here is something called a shell object watcher, okay? Which we knew it up, pointed at our library, which we loaded up using our hard-coded library name, because they've got full control over everything else. You don't need to let them pick their library name. And then I set up an event handler for what happens when something happens. And that event handler, there's 2 different kinds of events, dealing with a folder that's in the library, losing or gaining a file, versus changing what folders are in the library. So we actually do some looking at the change type and some casting around. Basically, we can figure out which kind of change it was, and then do something more exciting than putting code in the list box, right? Process the file, upload the file, update the database, send the emails, whatever it is that you're supposed to do when something new arrives. And we just say in the list box, it was an update, it was an item create. You could have an if. If the change type is item create, do this. If it's something else, maybe you're not going to do anything, right? So you can very easily react to that. I can stop watching. That's really just a matter of calling stop on the watcher and then disposing it, setting it to null, and lighting it on fire and throwing it in the river and generally making it stop watching. And one weird thing, when I go to delete my library, tear it down, there's no Windows API to delete a library. So what you need to know is that hidden away in something known as the library's known folder is actually little tiny text files, the format of which is none of our business, that represent the library. And if you open them up in Notepad, they're just XML, and you can see the paths and some other settings in there. In order to delete the library, you actually delete these little files. Okay? So here I'm again using environment.specialfolder to find my way to the library's known folder. And then I build a path based on my library name. And this extension, .library-ms, which is the extension for the library files. And then I call delete. So I actually delete that file. That's what actually deletes my library. So you see here I've got Kate Demo Library open. If I click tear down library, the library goes away. We actually end up a level because we can't be where we were, and the library is gone. Simple as that. So by hard coding the library name, you're writing 1 and 2 lines of code, 2 lines of code to create the library, 1 line of code to launch that managed UI so the user can put folders in and out. Super easy to set up a monitor or to do a file open that starts there or to do a file save that starts there. The user has great flexibility. They're really happy. And you're not maintaining config files, coping with people who want to have 6, 7, 8 entries. What if they go down to 0, da-da-da? Not your problem. You are monitoring literally a hard-coded library name. You maybe don't even need a config file because you're the one in charge of the name of the library. So that's very sweet. Again, just repeating the code here because it's easy to get you the decks. URLs. This one's easy to remember. developforwindows.com. Okay, I have it up here in the browser. Notice this nice big Get the Windows API Code Pack Download Now link. That's to save you from having to remember code.msdn.microsoft.com/Windows API Code Pack, which is the other URL I want you to know. And really, make your app a Windows 7 app. It is not hard. I think the longest of any technique I've just shown you is 4 lines of code, right? A lot of them are 1 or 2. And what a difference it makes to the way that the user interacts with your application. Am I right? So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to show you what Windows 7 can do for touch on your applications. What's going on with Windows 7 with multi-touch enables certain kinds of games where two different people are touching the screen at once, or where you're just interacting in more complicated ways with your UI. And one of the fun things that happens when you move to Windows 7 and you bring up some touch hardware like this one is that there's some capability given by the OS without your app knowing anything. Okay? So many of you probably have a mouse with a scroll wheel, right? You roll that scroll wheel and the app you're looking at scrolls up and down. Tons and tons of apps understand that. So there are touch gestures that are equivalent to scrolling, and Windows will automatically map those for your app. So let me just bring up a file. I don't want that one. Forgive me. I'm going to bring up a file in some kind of unlikely things. I'm going to take this piece of C# code and open it in Notepad. And I know it's really small and you can't read it, but this isn't about reading it, okay? I'm just going to take my finger and grab onto the screen, and I can scroll up and down the document just like this. Now, this isn't because Notepad has thrilling and exciting touch support added in. It's because Windows takes this series of movements, touch down, the finger move, and the touch up, and maps them to a scroll message that Notepad already knows how to deal with. Okay? So for some applications, you may have a text box or a scroll window or a list box with a scroll bar on it, and users be able to interact with it this way without you writing any code to make that happen. Another really popular built-in thing is zooming. Notepad doesn't really zoom well. My mouse cursor has decided to take a nap. This makes it kind of difficult to, there we go, drag and drop. So I'm going to take the same document and bring it into Word. So again, I can obviously scroll in Word, but Word also understands zooming. So if I take my two fingers close together, touch the screen, and then pull them apart, okay, Word actually now zooms, bumps up the percentage of what size my text is. And I can take my fingers far apart and push them together, and that will be like zooming out. Okay? So again, these messages, this gesture, is being mapped automatically to a zoom message that applications already understand. Okay? So that's kind of simple and built-in capability that you don't need to change your application in order to work with. But the chances are that you want to do something slightly more exciting than that. So you deal with two different possible sets of messages. One is a series of gesture messages. So zooming, which is touch, touch, and then the fingers get closer together, is a gesture. Rotating, which is touch, touch, and then you're moving around on an angle, is a gesture. And so is flick, where you sort of touch, move, and your speed increases as you go through the move. That's considered a flick. And that's different than just plain moving something. A lot of applications will use a flick motion to say that you want to maybe delete something or move something away in a different way than just moving it around might be. So to show you some of those gestures in action and to also kind of give you some inspiration, I want to show you some code from something called, or not code, but some running of what Microsoft calls the Touch Pack. Now the Touch Pack was originally only for OEMs, for companies like Dell that would make a touch unit. They could come and install the touch pack on it and ship it out with a touch pack on it. And then when it's sitting around on the shelves in Future Shock, you'd have some way to interact with it and see how cool touch was. So I'll show you a couple things from touch pack. One is this program called Collage. And Collage lets you play around, literally play, with pictures. So I can touch a picture down here in this bottom bar and pull it up onto the work surface to work with it. And I can grab another one and pull it up there. And if I don't want this koala anymore, I can flick him down and he disappears back into the tray and I'm not going to be working with him. And I can just touch them to move them around. And I can also resize them exactly the same way as we zoomed in Word. I can rotate them, bring him on top just by touching him. And if I give them a push, it's kind of hard to see, but I'll try to pull my hand way back so you can see right away what's going on. If I kind of give him a push and let go, he keeps moving, okay, even after my finger is not on him anymore. That's called inertia, and it's really an important part of a good touch experience. Something else that's an important part of a good touch experience, I have to change the background color for you to see this, is a shadow effect. When I click on these pictures, I'll try the coffee cup. Do you see that shadow? It gives the sense that it's lifted up from the screen. That tells you, gives you feedback that I've got hold of it. I've picked it up. And then I can expect that when that shadow is showing that I can pick it up and move it. And if I hold on here long enough, the shadow goes away. It says, I guess you didn't mean to pick me up. When I move my finger in this context, I'm not moving the picture around. So the shadow is some really important feedback to the user about kind of the mode that we're in. These little subtle touches, when you want to make a really immersive touch experience, you have to look at those really subtle touches. Now, there's more to touch than stretching and shrinking and rotating and moving. There are some way more immersive things that you can do. And to show you those, I thought I'd show you this screensaver called Lagoon. It's also part of the touch pack. This is a screensaver that runs when you leave your machine idle for long enough. And interacting on the touch screen doesn't knock you out of the screensaver. Okay, you have to wiggle the mouse or type to knock yourself out. So left to his own devices, obviously a bunch of fish swimming around. But if I touch the screen, it makes splashes in the water. Okay, and because this is multi-touch, I can touch with all five fingers at once and drag, and you can see multiple trails in the water. So this is obviously a lot more complicated than zooming in or zooming out or rotating, right? It's actually capturing the individual touch messages. And it's kind of cute. When I splash the water, the fish run away in terror. But if I put my finger here and wait in a single location, this is a different kind of gesture entirely. As time goes by, the fish come to check me out. Okay? So they'll all start to gather around where I'm touching. And then when I let go, they'll take off again. So you can't just capture gestures if you wanted to code something like Lagoon. You need to catch each individual touch, up, down, move, even understand how fast I'm moving my finger so you know how big to make the waves that my finger is causing in this imaginary water. So if you want to write this kind of immersive touch application, you have to catch these individual touch messages. So that's down, move, up, as opposed to having them combined for you into a gesture like rotate or pan, panning and scrolling, move you horizontally and vertically, or zooming in and out. So the first question you have to ask yourself when you think about, hey, that touch is pretty sweet. It's not very expensive to add touch hardware into people's lives these days. Maybe I'd like to put some touch in my app. The very first question you have to ask is, do people use your application to consume or to produce? I've heard this also described as lean forward and lean back. So lean back, consuming. I'm watching a video. Okay? I'm fine with touching pause and play and volume controls on the screen itself. It's not terribly precise work. If I miss, I'll just try again in a second. Scrolling, reading blogs, flicking on the screen the way you saw me scrolling through Word, that's easy to do, right? And if I mess up and I scroll too far, I'll just pull it back down again. It's fine. So it's very simple to add touch to a lean back kind of application because there's not tremendous demands on the UI in a lean back application. And for people, literally will lean back on the couch with a tablet. This machine here is convertible, so the screen rotates and folds down to form a tablet. Or with the, we're sure to have them soon, slates. You lean back and you watch your video or you read your blogs, or you scroll through your long Word document, and you don't have tremendous amount of precision in your UI. But the other half of the world is the lean forward. We're literally, you know, think about how you are at your keyboard. You're literally leaning forward to type all your code or to type that mail message or to build that document. And it's not always about typing. If you've got a design that you're building in Visio or some other visual modeling tool, maybe the architecture tools in Visual Studio, you're drawing a picture, making the boxes bigger, moving this guy over, adjusting this line. It's not about typing, but you're very, very intensely focused on what you're doing. Even if I was using a tool like that collage to rearrange pictures on the screen, if what I was doing was designing an ad campaign, that would be super intense lean forward behavior, right? When you're writing a lean forward app, your user experience has a much higher bar set. It has to be right. It's tremendous precision. People will be very irritated if they miss select. They meant to click OK, but they click cancel. They meant to click save, but they click don't save. That makes people really bitter, right? So you have a much higher bar when people are producing with your app. So you think about how to get really immersive. The chances are in a touch situation there, you're going to need to capture these individual messages, maybe all the way down to the individual touch messages. There are some controls and some libraries that'll make your life a little simpler, but your very first question has got to be, how important is it that this UI be optimized for touch versus, say, optimized for mouse? So let me show you, I'm actually going to do something rather collage-like over and over again in different technologies. And let's start with this. How many of you are Surface programmers? It's really not surprising that nobody is a Surface programmer. Surfaces cost like $20,000. There are a handful of Surface programmers. I know like two in the world. Okay, so that was an unfair question. How many of you are WPF4 programmers? I'm getting like 2 out of 50. WPF something older. About 2 or 3 times as many hands. Windows Forms. I do know all your shoulders work. Okay. Everybody's a Windows Forms programmer. So I'm going to show you doing the same thing in Windows Forms, and then in WPF4, and then with the help of some Surface libraries. And I'm sorry to say that the moral of the story is that although you can do this work in Windows Forms, you're almost certainly going to choose not to. Okay? So my Windows Forms demo comes from the Windows 7 training kit, which you can download, and I'll show you how to find that when I get to the resources section. And you can see that it is a complicated solution with a bunch of different demos all in the same solution. And I'm going to run this one here that's called MT Inertia. Up it comes, and it may be hard to tell at first, but let me pull them apart so you can see what we're dealing with. This is trying to be collage, right? It, for simplicity, it only opens 4 pictures out of the same folder that collage looks in. And as you can see, they open up very small. I'm going to try to make them bigger. Bear with me. There we go. Now, the inertia is cranked up. You see, my hands are nowhere near the screen, right? And it's still moving. This is an inertia sample, so they've really turned the inertia up a lot so that when you're finished moving it, it still moves. Okay, calm down. Got wildly crazy desert. Try to make someone else big. Apparently, I've had my chance when it comes to successfully enlarging pictures. They're so tiny, they may not look very tiny on the screen, but my fingers basically completely fill up the picture, and it's hard to get them both in there in order to get the zoom event. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to get anyone else big today. Oh, well. Oh, my coffee cup's going to get big for me. It's not as sweet as collage, is it? It's a little bit clunky, a little bit hard to do, and yet it's got a lot of code. First of all, we got references in here. We've got references to other projects in the same solution. So inertia is referring over to gesture. Got all kinds of XAML references, WPF references, and then we've got not one but 2 wrapper libraries. And these wrapper libraries, Windows 7.Multitouch and Windows 7.Multitouch.WinForms, are downloaded as part of that Windows 7 training kit. Okay? So there's a lot of kind of moving parts and things that you have to deploy. And then on top of that, this file alone is over 300 lines long. Okay? And it's only doing that. There's no way to add more pictures or bring guys up from the tray below or anything like that. So it's hundreds of lines of code. And what it's doing, you can see some of the variables here, stuff about angular velocity and initial velocity. And what it does is it gets the two touch messages and says, how far apart in time were they? How far apart did you move your fingers? Therefore, what speed are you moving at? Therefore, what speed should I be zooming or rotating or whatever at? And then with the inertia, what happens is after the messages stop, we slowly decrease the velocity so that you kind of smoothly skid to a stop. So there's pages and pages of math work here, translating things, making things bigger and smaller. It's pretty hard work. I'm not saying you can't do it. Go ahead and download the Windows 7 training kit. You can get this sample. But this is over 400 lines of code, and you can see that it's a long way from optimal, right? So let me show you another piece of code. Now, this particular code is WPF for code. And I have the exe here that I can run. Now, rather than loading a picture, he just loads a blue square. But you can imagine it's not much work to put the picture in here instead of the square. And I can touch the square, pull it around, make it bigger, make it smaller, rotate it, give it a little flick. It'll go carry on by itself for a while. So that's pretty nice. I think it's better than the Windows Forms version. It's a little bit smoother. So you're thinking, okay, maybe I should figure out how WPF works. And if I had to write 300 lines in Windows Forms, how many lines of code do I have to write in WPF 4? How does 275 sound? Did I open the right thing? I did. Scroll down to the bottom. That's line 76. Okay? And frankly, some of that is the using statements that were generated for you, right? So a lot less code. Maybe 1/5 or 1/6 the code. Because some of this capability is now being provided to you by WPF. Now, we're still doing some work with transforming matrices and figuring out inertias and decelerations and so on. There's still a fair amount of work in it. I want to leave him running and open another project. Okay, this is also a WPF4 app. We've got some XAML, and I'm just going to run him. Another square. Pick them up, drag them around, make them bigger, make them smaller. Now, do you notice a couple things? First of all, do you see the little like highlight dots in the square? They're actually showing you where my fingers are. Okay? They're a little hard for me to see because my fingers are on them, but I can see them kind of blurting around the edges of my finger. It's a little better feedback. Let's go back to our blue square. There's no such feedback in here. Okay? Another kind of subtle thing, remember the shadow in Collage? When I pick this square up, we get the shadow. And as I move him around, the shadow actually even shifts. That's just showing off, really. And then I let go, and the shadow disappears. The blue square, no shadow. Don't get that feedback that says, yeah, you have picked it up. When I fling the blue square at the edge, he just stops like he's landed in plasticine or something. Over here, if I fling this guy at the edge, he bounces back. Okay? It's really the sort of thing that makes people feel that it's like a realistic UI, that they get these smooth to a stop or even bounce back off edges. So this is obviously a way more sophisticated sample, right? We've got the finger highlights that are showing you about the rotating. We've got the shadow on the pickup. We've got the bouncing from the edges. We were down to 75 lines of code. How much more code do you think we have to go up to in this better demo? How about zero? Does zero work for anybody? This is the code behind for that running code. All there is this initialized component call that the wizard makes for you. There's absolutely no my code whatsoever in here. Okay? Why? I'm using a toolkit. All the smart boys and girls use toolkits, and specifically the Surface toolkit for Windows Touch. So Surface is this very sophisticated, complicated, expensive piece of equipment for which a lot of code has been written by some real smart people. And to take that code, those libraries, and bring them into Windows gives you these wonderful capabilities. So here's my XAML. I have a grid. In the grid, I have something called a scatter view. A scatter view is like what you saw in Collage. It's a view on which items will be strewn, right? And that control understands that there's things in it that are going to be moved around. Inside the scatter view, there's a scatter view item. A scatter view knows, hey, people are going to pick me up, stretch me, switch me, rotate me. That's fine. That's what I'm here for. And then just to make life simple, we just put an empty view box inside the scatter view item. But you guys can totally see how you could put a picture in here or whatever else you wanted to, right? And everything's handled by the Surface toolkit. The stretching, the rotating, the inertia, the bouncing off the edges of the scatter view, the shadow highlight when I pick it up, the little finger glows to show where I'm rotating it, all handled by the controls. No code of mine at all. So the Windows Forms life, 350 lines of code plus all those references, including to the other projects in the same solution, which also have hundreds and hundreds of lines of code. WPF 4 life, not bad, 75 lines of code, but it's not great. Surface toolkit life, 0 lines of code, 5 lines of XAML, and it's better than either of the other two. This is not the story that I used to tell when Windows was still in beta, when Windows 7 was not yet released. Okay, this is the fall 2010 story, and it's a pretty darn good one. Okay. The Surface toolkit, if you want traditional kinds of controls that you could expect to see in a touch app, these are really going to help you. Is it going to help you write the lagoon with the waves when you move your fingers through the water? No. Okay. For that, you're going to be handling touch events. But if you want to be able to have a UI in which people have a list of, what were we doing before, approving purchase orders, and you fling them into the yes and the no piles, you can totally see how you could use the scatter view to do that very easily, right? And not have to write a ton of code. So I really want you to see that progression down to less and less and less code as we move to newer and newer and newer libraries. That's the XAML, in case you wanted it, for this code. I'm actually going to tell you where to get all of this code when we get into the resources. Now, you may have noticed that I did not exclusively use the touch capabilities of this machine while I was doing the demos with you. Okay? You can tell when I'm using the mouse, by the way, because there's a mouse cursor on the screen. Whereas if I'm using touch, do I still have that? The mouse cursor disappears while I'm touching. Okay? And so when I was opening files in Visual Studio, that was all about the mouse. When I was switching between the XAML and the C#, that was all about the mouse. And the reason why? These things are tiny. Okay? For me to try to touch them to successfully, that's not what I want to click, okay? But that's what I'm happening to click. And that's just really the story of a mouse-oriented UI when you come at it with your fingers. Okay? Now, there's a big 25-inch all-in-one unit that I also sometimes use for demos, and then that scrolls all the controls up so nice and big that my fingers don't feel enormous. But on this little laptop, the most Windows controls, I just cannot hit them. So as a designer, if you're going to write an application, how can you help, right? You can make maybe the buttons bigger. Okay, you can't make scroll bars bigger. You can't make checkboxes bigger. So some things are out of your control. The other thing you can do that will help is to have more gaps between controls. It's really frustrating to miss. It's super frustrating to miss and hit the totally wrong thing. Okay, so just pulling things a little further apart gives me more room so I'm less likely to hit the wrong thing. And you have to tell people what's going on. That shadow when you pick up the picture is so subtle, but it's real. People have to know, yeah, I heard you. That click worked. We're in business. And speaking of clicking, how many of you have apps where if you hover over things, you get a tooltip? Yeah? Sure. It's normal behavior. You can't hover with touch. Okay? It's touch or touch not. There is no hover. Okay? It's not like, oh, you're close. I think I'll show you the tooltip. You either touch it or you don't. So if you've got a life that's really tooltip-oriented, that's kind of a pain. And let me show you what right-clicking looks like. Let's do it in Notepad. I'll select some text. By the way, ordinary, what we call panning, just one finger selecting, in most apps doesn't scroll sideways, it selects. But this scrolls, because that's the assumption that you don't usually select vertically, but you scroll vertically. Okay? So I select some text, and then if I click on here, touch and hold, see that circle that appears? Now when I let go, I let go too late, let me do it as soon as the circle appears, I get a right-click menu. Okay? Now you can see, I've been practicing, and I didn't get a right-click menu on my first try. So if you write an application with a grid, and you're supposed to choose an item in the grid, and right-click approve, right-click deny, people are not going to be very happy. They're going to accidentally right-click the wrong thing, their arms are going to get tired. That's not really a very touch-friendly UI. And you might want to change that into something where they flick things over into the approved and denied folders, or at least have buttons, like approve and deny buttons hanging out on the end. It is possible, just as I showed you can tell whether you're running on Windows 7 or not. You can tell whether you have multi-touch support or not. You can prove this trivially. Go search for the Windows Touch Pack. Find it, download it, run it on your non-touch enabled machine, fire up Collage, and it goes, meh, you don't have multi-touch. Thanks for playing. Okay? So it's very easy to figure out whether you're on touch or not. If the person has touch, maybe you should change your UI a little bit to support that kind of their life. Maybe give them some buttons, maybe move things apart a little bit, that kind of thing. So right-clicking, not obvious and not easy once you're trained on it. But as you can see, using the Surface Toolkit is really going to help. And not just because it takes care of things like the feedback, but also because it contains a set of analogs to the existing Windows controls that are much touch-friendlier. So let me show you one more demo. Guy is called Surface Control Comparison. He's actually from a book by Joshua Blake, and I'll give you the URL to get Joshua's sample code. And what he's done in this particular piece, if you download his code, you get a whole book's worth of sample code, and hopefully you're interested in his book as well, because it's a good one. But what he's done in this particular app is he's built the XAML, he's put traditional WPF controls and controls from the Surface Toolkit side by side. Now these aren't like the scatter view control that's super touch oriented, but they're just touch versions of existing controls. So if I try to click this button, I get really irritated. There we go. It takes me a lot of tries to successfully click this button. The Surface button, I get much, much better hit rates on. And notice how it reacts when I click it. It lights up, it gets bigger, it says, yes, I definitely heard you. One of the things you need to know is that when you're using a touch UI, your finger is on the screen. So, for example, if I check a checkbox, I maybe don't see if it's checked or not because I put my finger on it. When I check the Surface checkbox, it lights up and flashes, and even around my finger, I can see that I successfully hit it. Okay? Super important. Same with these sliders. They get wider, and you can see the light up. This slider down here. Go, it gets much wider, you can see it even around my finger, and this canvas also gives me more feedback about where my finger is and how I'm drawing. So with the Surface-specific controls, the touch user is going to be a lot happier. Now they still work with the mouse. If I bring the mouse cursor into play, you can see that I can choose these Surface radio buttons just as easily as I can choose these radio buttons, so there's nothing magical that it has to be touch. But they do this, ooh, I see you, and a big flash of light and all of that to the mouse the same as they do to your finger. So when you use the controls from the Surface Toolkit, even when you're building like a traditional gray boxes on a gray background line of business app, you make it naturally more touch-friendly simply by swapping out, you know, a traditional WPF checkbox with that tiny, tiny little box for a Surface checkbox, which is bigger and more responsive and gives you that feedback. So, some resources. Again, I'm hoping that you're going to get the slides. I understand all of these URLs are horrible. In fact, the URL for the Surface Toolkit for Windows Touch was so horrible I couldn't bring myself to paste it in to the PowerPoint. But I do have them all up in a browser, so why don't we kind of talk about them. This is the MSDN help for touch and manipulation. And there's a lot of it, okay? It goes on for pages and pages, and it's full of cool stuff. Like this one right here shows you what I was telling you about the scroll, how we have touch enter, followed by touch down, followed by any number of touch moves, followed by a touch up and a touch leave. And all of that gets mapped into this scrolling that we see on the screen. And if you can just catch those mapped gestures, you're obviously a lot better off than if you were to try to process each of those individual touch events. If you want people to trail their fingers in the water and scare the fish, catch the individual touch events, but you'd be happier with gestures if you can. And then these are manipulations like zooming and rotating, and they're all in that MSDN. Here is the download page for the Windows 7 Training Kit for Developers, and you can simply search for that, Windows 7 Training Kit for Developers. Just be warned, it's really a pretty big download, and it's way more than just touch, okay? It's libraries and restart and recovery and taskbar and many of the things that I've showed you throughout the day, but it's pretty old. It was last updated a year ago, okay? So quite a few things have changed, and specifically a lot of the wrappers that it uses have been replaced by the Windows API code pack. So about the only piece of this that I'd really like you to spend much time in is if you wanted to look at the Windows Forms samples for multi-touch. But as you've seen, they're really not my first choice for how you would do this. In fact, if you're an absolutely dedicated Windows Forms developer, probably what you want to do is host a WPF control on your Surface. Okay, so you've got your buttons and your ribbons and your toolbars and your tree controls and whatever else that people have to use a mouse for. And then somewhere you've got your kind of maybe a canvas that you're going to let people draw on, and they draw with the mouse now and you'd like to let them draw with their fingers. That's great. Replace that with a WPF, or better still, a Surface canvas out of the Surface toolkit. Host that WPF control on your Windows Form and carry on from there, rather than trying to cope with all this stuff yourself in Windows Forms. That's my advice. But you can still download the training kit if you want to convince yourself by looking at the samples. This is a code gallery page, code.msdn.microsoft.com/windows-touch, full of resources for developers who want to do touch work, including downloading some wrappers and some more samples. There's also a link here to the download for the Surface Toolkit. Look at that URL. It's just outrageous. So it's got a GUID in it. I'm just not putting that in the PowerPoint for you, okay? Just search for the Microsoft Surface Toolkit for Windows Touch. That will bring you here. It says beta. It also says it was last updated in April. So I guess it's been in beta since April. Okay, whatever. It's fine. Works just fine. I don't know if it's ever going to come out of beta. I'm not privy to that. I do know that it works beautifully and that it's going to chop a ton of effort off your development time, and at the same time improve the quality of the solution you're giving your users very dramatically. So I strongly encourage you to be part of the whole Microsoft Surface Toolkit. This is the MSDN support for Surface with links to user experience guidelines and those sorts of things, as well as another way to get the download the beta, so-called. And this is Guy Smith Ferrier's page. Guy is an internationalization, Silverlight, and multi-touch fellow. He works in England, in Bristol, and he gave me the code that I showed you for the blue square and the five lines of XAML gradient square. Okay, so if you want those pieces of code, you'll get them here from where it says source code on this delightfully named Touch Me, Stretch Me, Squeeze Me, the Windows 7 WPF multi-touch story. Okay, so if you want the Windows Forms code, you go to the Windows 7 Training Kit. If you want the other two, the middle two demos with the blue square and the gradient square, you get them here from Guy's page. And the last piece of the puzzle, the Surface Controls comparison, is from Joshua Blake's book on natural user interfaces with WPF and Silverlight, published by Manning. And you see this link here to the source code. That's all the source code for the whole book. And if you poke around in there, you'll find this Surface Controls comparison demo, which is the guy that I just showed you. And that one, which I still have open in Visual Studio, has almost no code. It's got a couple click counts on the buttons. That's all the code does. Really, it's about the XAML that puts together all those controls side by side, lets you compare them and see which one you want. Okay? So code.msdn.microsoft.com/windows-touch. Series of WPF resources over on MSDN, and of course Guy Smith Ferrier's resources for these two samples that I showed you. It's really not logical to do Windows 7 multi-touch in anything other than WPF 4. I think I've shown you enough for that. You're welcome to drill into the code yourself, but really, WPF 4 and especially those Surface Toolkit controls, they're going to get you where you need to be pretty darn quickly. Now, if you're writing a lean-forward app, you need to put some serious effort into thinking about how people are going to interact with your UI when they can't hover, when they can't right-click, when they need bigger controls. What gesture works well? Is there a place here for flicking? Is there a place here for zooming? How can people indicate what they want to do? That effort, that thinking, is not about writing code. It's going to be about meeting people and asking them about how they'd like to interact and maybe completely changing the paradigm of your app. But once you kind of know, as much as you can, you want to leverage that Surface Toolkit, and then when you have to catch individual gestures or catch individual touch events, you'll kind of know how to do that. If you're actually writing an app and you admit it to yourself, you know what, this is a mouse app. I get that some people are going to have touch screens, and I don't want to disenfranchise them, but it's really a mouse app. What can you do that's easy that doesn't disenfranchise those touch users? Make your controls a little bit bigger. Make your controls a little bit further apart, okay? Because the point of a mouse cursor is much, much smaller than the point of a finger, even a little girly finger. And certainly, if you've got something in a warehouse where guys who lift up large cardboard boxes are going to click that they put something on the truck, you better have a nice big thing for those great big strong fingers to hit, right? If you do nothing else, test your app on a touch device, okay? This laptop, which is touch-enabled, is lightweight and thin, and I'm seriously considering, I'm about ready to replace the laptop that I did the first half of the session on, seriously considering a touch laptop for a replacement. You can also buy add-on touch screens that you can just connect to your existing laptop or desktop or whatever for like $300, okay? Really not a huge investment to buy one such thing for your whole team, and every once in a while, put that as a secondary screen on one of your devices and put the app over on there and try interacting with it by touch and see what happens. And you may very quickly decide, you know what, we need to make a few little changes here to be a little more touch friendly, even if you're fundamentally a mouse application. You really have to experience for yourself trying to check that checkbox or trying to check that button and consistently missing before you kind of get it and say, okay, how can we make this a little friendlier to the mouse or to the touch when there is no mouse and there is no keyboard. So with that, I have time for some questions, and we can also take questions both from the online, if there are any, as well as from here inside the room, and I encourage you to ask me about either half, the touch half or the CodePack half, anything to do with building apps for Windows 7. Yes?
Say I build an app with Surface library. Will this later translate to work on a Surface?
So the question is, if you use the Surface Toolkit for Windows, and then you kind of get into, hey, I'd really like to use the Surface Toolkit for Surface, I think you should be in a pretty good place. part of the reason for having a Surface Toolkit for Windows was people who didn't want to buy $20,000 test units to deploy and test to, right? Like Surface is a pretty serious commitment. And if you could emulate some of it on a Windows machine, you'd be happier, right? So what you'll see over time is WPF and Surface, their libraries meshing closer and closer together so that the skills that you take to one will apply to the other. The other question people sometimes ask is about Silverlight, and I have to say Surface Toolkit is WPF, not Silverlight, right? Silverlight is a subset of WPF. We're not saying work in Silverlight, we're saying work in WPF4. Okay, you got. That's where your big sweetest spot is right now for multi-touch work on Windows 7. Obviously, when you're on the phone, you're in Silverlight, but we're not talking about the phone tonight. Other questions? Yes. Is there an easier way to bring Windows Forms apps into WPF 4? There are two things that you can do. One is that you can continue to be a Windows Forms application, but that where you had a great big white square that was a Windows Forms control that people interacted with, have instead a great big white square that's a WPF control that people interact with. So your app doesn't have to stop being a Windows Forms app, but you're using WPF4 for this thing. Okay, so that's just change swapping out the control, exactly. There's a little bit of work to host a WPF control in a WinForms application, but you can find the samples and demos pretty quickly. The other thing is, and it's completely experimental and educational and not production quality and so on, but more than one person has written converters that will try to convert your WinForms app into a WPF app. Because if you think about it, they both contain some declarative statements that say, I have a button that's this big and that's located here. And even the event handlers are also there declaratively. So if you do, again, a little searching, I know there's at least one on CodePlex that will, it doesn't catch every control, it doesn't get all the positioning perfectly, but especially for you understanding, you can convert your app, then look at the code and say, oh, I get it, I understand what these constructs mean now in XAML, and so maybe that would be the sort of impetus to get you to actually convert the whole app to WPF if you wanted to. But it's not a requirement. You can use WPF for the touch part while your app as a whole is still Windows Forms, right? By simply hosting a different kind of control in your application. Make sense? So today you can deploy a Windows Forms application to all the same platforms that you can deploy a WPF4 application to. It doesn't really make an impact on your platforms. It's not like Silverlight, which does support, can be in the browser or can be out of the browser. Both WPF and Windows Forms are desktop applications that have nothing to do with web browsers. The difference going forward is that Windows Forms is done. There isn't going to be another version of Windows Forms. No such thing has been said for WPF. You can expect for WPF to have like a, rich kind of support. And so a lot of things are showing up in WPF that aren't showing up in Windows Forms, and certainly Touch is a classic example of that. So why do things the hard way if there's a way for you to move along and do them the easy way? That's really what it's about, as opposed to being about reach. Speaking of reach, I should mention that when you use the Surface Toolkit, there's a small runtime that you need to distribute with your app. Okay? And you can download that runtime when you download the toolkit and include it in your deployment package for your application. Question here.
When doing WPF apps between Windows XP and 7, I've noticed a lot of controls are obviously going to be different sizes when you try and have them running in both environments, and it can mess up them your layout. Is there any way to go about supporting that a little better rather than detecting an OS and then making very meticulous changes?
So I'll just repeat the question. You've got a WPF, is it 4? WPF4 application that you are running the same executable on both XP and 7, but the default rendering of the controls, because WPF, like any Windows app, actually asks Windows to do a lot of the work for it. And XP and 7 render things slightly differently. Menus look different, buttons look really different, and so your UI, if you've planned it down to the pixel, doesn't look quite so identical between the two OSs. And you are right that the really kind of best practice way to handle that is to do some version detection of the OS. You can use the code pack, for example, to help you figure out what OS you're on very simply. But then the question is, would you then change the individual properties of all the controls, or would you actually swap out entire blobs of XAML? And that may be the simpler thing to do, is to sort of carefully handcraft the XP XAML and the Windows 7 XAML, and then at runtime bring in the right XAML, rather than setting 73 properties on 52 controls. That probably would make you crazy in a hurry. Yeah. Question here. For the Surface Toolkit, can you use Expression? I actually do not know. If you drop me an email, I will try to find out for you. Okay? I would hope with yes. But I wouldn't want to say yes and then look foolish. So I'm going to say I don't know. But send me an email. In fact, let me... There. Okay. Any more questions in the room? Yes.
The first part, you know, the taskbar thumbnails?
The taskbar thumbnails, yes.
Below it,
the actual icons on the taskbar itself.
When you hover over it, and
correct.
The color changes.
That's correct. Very few people notice that. That's interesting. Let me actually demo that. So when you hover your mouse over the icons on the taskbar, the color changes. It's called the hot light. And you notice here PowerPoint, it's mostly red, whereas here Notepad, it's pale blue. It's incredibly sophisticated heuristic. What is the most common color in the icon? Okay, so PowerPoint's made out of red and white, red wins. Okay, Visual Studio's made out of blue and purple, so it's kind of blue. And folders here, they're made out of yellow, so it comes up yellow. If you don't like the hot color that you're getting, you have to change the relative proportions of colors in your icon. Okay, and so that the most common color is green, and then your highlight will come up green. Okay, simple as that. Yeah, there's quite a lot of heuristics about how they light these up so that people know what they're over. And it actually is one of the things that your progress bars and your taskbar overlays, they don't show up as well when you have focus because then you have that that white highlight as well as maybe a hotspot highlight as well. Yeah. Sure. The question online, can I change the rectangle used by the taskbar? For your clipping, yes. You can set your thumbnail clip to clip a simpler version of your application, one line of code with the code pack. Yes. And the key thing to search for there would be the word set thumbnail clip with no spaces, and that should find it for you very easily. Question here. Yes. Right. Can you take control over the buttons that have been added in the thumbnail? No. You can't take any control at all. You have to add them all in a single call if you want four or two. You can have up to seven. Can't have more. And you have one call to add thumbnail buttons in which you add them all in, and then they are laid out by windows, and it decides how to center them and where to position them. If you wanted two rows of three, too bad. You can't. You would get one row of six. Nor can you play tricks like, well, I'll make three buttons, but I'll figure out if you clicked on the top or the bottom half because you just have a click handler. Okay, so you have to kind of play within the paradigm that you've been given, up to seven buttons that will be laid out in one row. Yeah. Well, I think that's all the questions that we have. So I'd like to thank the people who are online. We're going to close down the webcast for them first, and as well thank all of you. And people who are online, please click the simulcast eval and evaluate the session. Everybody wants you to do that for sure. And I also want those of you who are in the room to do your paper evals. And thank you all for coming.